This week, NPR Music is launching an R&B channel called I'll Take You There, hosted by Jason King, a professor, writer, and musician. It's a lot like the 24/7 stream of hip-hop that Ali and I host, so for this episode of Microphone Check, we're adding some R&B to the mix by talking to Solange Knowles, the singer and songwriter who got her start dancing and writing for her sister, Beyoncé. We start our conversation in hip-hop. Solange tells us about getting suspended in middle school over a Nas poster in her locker, compares her singing style to Silk the Shocker's flow, and says she still can't believe she got Bun B and Manny Fresh to dance in the video for her song, Lovers in the Parking Lot.
I actually messaged him, like, thank you so much. He's like, yeah, thank God I still have my G card after that.
It's a dance move.
Like, you will never lose that. And then Manny was just adorable. But Manny's been dancing. He used to do the Dougie before the Dougie.
This fall, Solange started a label called Saint Records, which she calls a passion project that will primarily house R&B artists. We talk about her hopes for the label, the relevance of gospel to R&B, recent journalism around the genre, and, of course, Lucy Pearl. You can listen to I'll Take You There at NPR Music Radio and get all of NPR's coverage of R&B on Twitter at NPRANDB.
I'll never be picture-perfect Beyoncé. Live with J-Lo, a singing baby like Shanti. I barely comb my hair, yeah, that's on a good day. I don't care what the hood say. I ain't street like Keisha, I never tried to be. And I got soul in my soul, but not quite like Mary. Ain't nothing really R&B about me. And as I bump with the hood say, I'm sorry I ain't in the business in my video.
This is Microphone Check from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly.
I'm Ali Shaheed.
And I'm Solange Knowles.
Thank you.
What up, Solange?
That felt so official.
So tell us, do you like hip-hop?
I love hip-hop. I have gone through many different phases in my love affair with hip-hop.
What do you mean?
I mean, it evolves your taste. It sometimes deepens in terms of what's out. Sometimes it's not as deep in terms of what's out.
Yeah.
So it's definitely an evolution. I don't ever claim to be a hip-hop head.
Really?
If you start quizzing me, I'll clam up and be like, whoa, 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 whoa.
All right, so the evolution.
The evolution, yes.
So who was like your earlier
loves? My earliest love, which was sort of an obsession, actually, was Nas. Mm-hmm. I was in seventh grade, I believe, and Nostradamus was out. And I took it pretty far. I listened to it. No, I mean, I actually was telling someone yesterday I got suspended over Nas.
What?
In eighth grade, I went to a very, very Christian school. Mm. I had the Godson shirt off poster in my locker across the belly. And the dean told me that I needed to remove the poster because it was blasphemous. And I argued that if I did, that the young lady two lockers down from me had to take down her Justin Timberlake poster because he had a cross tatted on his chest.
Nice.
And I didn't really see what the difference was there. So he told me he was giving me until Friday. It was a Wednesday. I went home, spoke with my parents about it, and my parents actually gave me the choice and the freedom to stand by it and accept the repercussions, if so, which was an in-school suspension. So
wow.
I took that for Nas.
That's a true fan.
Does he know this?
He does. I mean, I met him maybe in ninth grade, and by that time, he was signed to Columbia. My sister was signed to Columbia. So he had heard on several different occasions that there was this little girl who had Nas on her nails and Nas book cover and had been suspended. So it was pretty deep, but that was also like in my junior high, transitioning into high school, really feeling the need to express
going to
the depth of me.
Christian school, probably.
Yes, that rebellion, inspired. Exactly. And Nas was my poet.
Now let's get it all in perspective. For all y'all enjoyment, a song y'all can step with. Y'all appointed me to bring rap justice, but I ain't 5-0, y'all know it's Nas, yo. Grey Goose and a whole lot of hydro. Only describe us as soldier survivors. Stay laced in the best, well-dressed with finesse in the white tee, looking for white meat. Thug girl who fly and talk so nicely. Put her in the coupe so she can feel the nice breeze. We could drive through the city, no doubt, but don't say my car's topless. Say the titties is out. Newness, here's the anthem. Put your hand up that you shoot with, count your loot with. Push the pool stick in your new crib, same hand that you hoop with. Swing around like you stupid. King of the town. Yeah, I been that. You know I click clack where you and your men's at.
Through the smurf. I also kind of from that, which jumps sonically pretty majorly. I loved Cash Money.
Okay.
Early Cash Money. Growing up in Houston, having bounce music sort of just be in the fabric of my Houston childhood. You know, every party, every family reunion, you played your DJ Jubilee record. And so hearing Ha, I remember, and it having that bounce beat, but him spitting over it and his timing was so unique and abstract. It was really, really kind of his own timing. And then the visual just kind of took it to new heights for me.
That's a range.
There's a range.
It's kind of like this next question doesn't count, but I'm asked. So what's your guilty pleasure? Like, who?
Guilty pleasure. I don't know. I mean, I really don't listen to anyone that I'm not proud of saying that I listen to. You know, even if it's something a little bit more unexpected, which I didn't get too deep into, like, the Waka Gucci records, but, you know, I like those with pride.
Okay.
I mean, it's a range. There's, like, a Bow Wow record that Pharrell produced called The Movement that's incredible, still, like, one of my favorite.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to go back. I don't know this song.
Yeah. No future, no past. We live for the right now. Want us to bite down, but this is what life sounds like when the thugs cry. And I seen love die. And I seen a hate spawn. And born as it takes on form as we take on. The world is placed on our shoulders, but socially they never know what's up. They approach us with their preconceived notion. At least it's what the homies tell me. The celebration, the movement. Anything musically that I fully, fully believe is good, no matter who the artist is, no matter what the marketing is behind it, I stand pretty firm.
What do you think of the current state of hip-hop in terms of social content?
I'm celebrating it, honestly. I think the new wave of rappers, especially Kendrick, the Black Hippie Schoolboy, I love what they're doing. I think that's definitely something to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from a movement where everything was hyperhood and and was really, really sort of celebrating poverty,
right,
and celebrating selling the drugs and celebrating really just a lack of education.
I call it celebrating failure, but, you know, that's probably being harsh.
Harsh.
I'm just, you know.
Harsh.
I'm a lot older than you, so I think I can say that.
Absolutely.
But I'm going to adapt the way you put it because it's so much nicer.
Well, I mean, there's definitely truth to a lot of those stories,
yeah,
which you can't deny and disassociate from, which is the way that I try to look at it. That's a lot of people's truth. That's a lot of people's environment, whether it's right or wrong. you know, as an artist, everybody has the opportunity to celebrate and speak their truth.
True.
And so I definitely wasn't playing it for my 8-year-old, but every once in a while when you're in a party, it a little bit of that at a time feels good.
You feel it.
You feel it.
You feel a need to...
Every once in a while. I mean, I draw the line, and I'm definitely the friend and the crew that's like, you're overthinking it. But it's also certain social situations that I feel comfortable expressing myself to that music. And there's some of them that made me really uncomfortable. So.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people, though. Yeah. I mean, could you be a little bit more specific about that? Like, what
yeah,
is the problem?
Sure. I think there's just certain lyrics and certain forms of hip-hop that definitely rang true, again, to a lot of people's truth, but you don't necessarily want to hear someone using that as a just kind of in-the-moment, fun, careless expression, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, sure, it's the precarious sing-along.
For sure. And I actually... I'm very careful with it myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think just having a sensitivity in those situations is all that I kind of ask for.
I have a, you know, one of those sort of conflicting moments mm-hmm. every time I get to this one particular song that I know is going to just, the party's just going to go bonkers.
Right, what's
and
that?
And I've stopped playing it in the middle, just, you know, make an announcement like, really, okay, you guys got yours off of this, now I'm done, because I can't see this record to its end.
Right.
It's explosive.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Dre's Explosive.
Ah.
Such a great sounding record, but lyrically, I don't know, it pushes against me a little bit too much, so.
Explosive. West Coast shit, my niggerish. Ways a track, girls that used to turn they back, causing me to yank they arm and pose like I would do them all. Now I'm saying thank you, because they tell me my shit's the bomb. For my niggas drinking cognac, smoking weed, always fat, more than one firearm, chrome rims, rhino, chronic in your system, let me know, my sister bomb explosive.
West Coast shit, nigga, overdosage, imperial pistols, ferocious, fuck a bitch, don't tease bitch, strip tease bitch, eat a bowl of these bitch, gobble a dick.
I actually sampled that record, I covered it with a Dirty Projector song to the Explosive Dre beat.
You can play that now. There you go.
Thank you.
Different feeling it conveys, but
we'll see how the anthem we get the anthematic kind of
no. So wait, at which point do you stop playing it?
I don't know. It's just something in the body just starts to like. It's like okay, really.
Got it.
I just watch the crowd. I'm like, and I'm done.
Yeah.
Sorry, I apologize, but and they understand. Like
yeah,
it's me playing it.
Right. But I think every generation has that movement of hip-hop that you're playing it and you definitely have that moment of like, why am I saying this so enthusiastically? Why am I so stoked and psyched to sort of say these lyrics?
Do you think about that as a songwriter?
I do, but I don't think I ever approach those parallels lyrically that ever make me feel like this is something that I'd be uncomfortable hearing my son sing along with. It's not a conscious effort. It's just not my life. I mean, I've had songs. I had a song called Champagne Chronic Nightcap. But, you know, it was innocent in its own way. But that's probably as far as it goes.
I respect that.
Yeah.
So Strangers in the Night, you know? Classic song, sing a whole lot.
Yeah.
Strangers in the night, two lonely people, we were strangers in the night, up to the moment when we said our first hello, little did we know
Love was just a glance away, a warm embracing dance away, and ever since that night.
What do you play for your 8-year-old?
Well, you know, I honestly try to have the approach that this is real life. This is the real world that we live in. And I don't really try to shelter him from a lot of things that he's going to see when he looks out of the window. You know what I mean? There's obviously a certain level of profanity or sexual profanity that I draw the line at. But he loves Jay. He loves his latest album. He's actually going through a very interesting phase where he's loving dubstep, like loving sort of Europe drum and bass dubstep vibe. So
that is interesting.
It's super interesting because it's never been played in our household, but I think it's something that's sort of becoming a phenomenon with kids his age because I believe they have exposure to it through video games or something, but like he just randomly goes on YouTube and listens to Skrillex or a couple different other ones that I've never heard of. So it's really interesting because he's grown up listening to all types of music. And, you know, the natural form of rebellion is to find the one genre that maybe he hasn't listened to and to make that, you
the
know, his
he
thing.
Stands on.
Yeah.
Is there anything, any hip-hop you think it's important for him to hear, like, early on?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he knows a bunch of Tribe Records. He was actually, like, 4 saying Bonita Applebaum. Super, super cute. I have footage of it.
Should upload it so we can put it on our Facebook page.
And I've played him some Nas records. I kind of curate through the ones that I think are important for him to hear. And there's some newer hip-hop. There's some songs on Kendrick's record that he's into. But the thing about it is it's on the radio. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's all on the radio. So he also loves Macklemore, which is not an artist that I have in my rotation. But he, you know, it's on the radio. He responds to it. And it's positive.
Yeah.
So he's the first guy that I like had to do the my son loves you, will you take a picture with him?
Oh my god.
At the Roots picnic, and I just felt so annoying, like you're becoming
a
mom.
Woman. Yeah.
Like a real mom.
That's dope though, still though. You know, to have like another artist child appreciate your art.
Yeah.
It's kind of flattering.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. But, you know, I definitely felt nerdy.
This is probably going to make you feel a little bit more nerdy. I'm sorry. But are you ever influenced by any rapper's vocal technique? Like, as a singer, we've often observed that, like, your sister is sometimes singing like a rapper.
For sure.
How does that work in your head?
Well, I talk very slow. I move very slow. I definitely have that southern draw. And although I never necessarily participated in the activities that go along with Screw.
Thanks for clarifying.
I definitely was a huge fan of Screw. Anyone from Houston that hears this will know there were these tapes called Fuck Action. They'd take all of the R&B songs, which were already hella slow, and really, really, really chop and screw them.
I know it's been a long time since you heard from me and Michael Watts, but we ain't gone nowhere. Despite everything you heard, baby, the Swisher House ain't going nowhere. We here to stay.
It's 2 a.m. just getting in, about to check my message. No one's called, but my homies and some bill collectors.
So if I had to like create a parallel with anything, it'd be that, because melodically I don't ever really sing very staccato or very fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about a groove, it's really about a vibe. So I think maybe that has sort of seeped into my style a little bit, because I certainly used to jam the fuck action. They had like 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5.
I've never heard that word before.
I know, but it was a thing, and it was good.
Baby, why you looking so down? Seems like you need loving. Baby, baby, you need a girl like me around. Baby,
you know, even melodically, like Silk the Shocker, I used to love his flow. I love when rappers sort of have a offbeat, very abstract timing, and he certainly did. Love Tip's flow, absolutely love it. And any rapper who really approaches rapping with the art form of songwriting melodically, like I know a bunch of rappers who actually go in before they write the lyrics and come up with a melody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you can hear and feel that difference so much when that's the case.
Can you name a couple examples?
I just feel like such a little stan over here, but Kendrick is someone who does that really, really
well.
Yeah,
that's clear.
Jay is actually someone who does that really well. And it's interesting because my son went through a phase where he was like writing raps all day, every day. And Jay actually told me, I watched Jules write his rap and he came up with the melody first.
Mm.
And Whoa. He's like, that's really impressive, you know, for that age, for him to do that. And he's, you know, said that that's how he writes a lot of times.
I would say Bun B does.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That cameo is adorable.
Thank you. I still can't even believe it went down.
I can't with that.
I actually messaged him, like, thank you so much. He's like, yeah, thank God I still have my G card after that.
It's a dance move.
I'm like, you will never lose that.
Back and forth behind and down.
And Manny was just adorable. But Manny's been dancing. He used to do the Dougie before the Dougie.
Just saying, it's a part of hip hop. Like
it is.
Like you can't disconnect it. You got
no. Yeah, but a lot of people are like afraid to dance in hip hop now and just have fun and be goofy.
Just
and silly
find those videos when they were 12 years old, and now just take care of that. You know. How do you like working with rappers? Like I know you work with a few.
Yeah. I've been very lucky in all of my experiences. I worked with Wayne on the Champagne Chronic Nightcap one. Kendrick did a verse on Look Good With Trouble. Wale did a verse on this F the Industry song I had. But other than that, it's been pretty limited.
Do you go in with these guys or do they just send you send you their verses?
They send me the verses. And Tip actually did a verse on Sandcastle.
Okay.
Yeah, I've yet to work alongside. But again, I've just been very, very lucky that in those situations, all of them have been very musical.
Mm-hmm.
It's never been a situation where I've had to send something back.
Give me time to clear up my throat in. I'ma say some shit for you to quote in. I'm good to close on those and plus shows. I spin the records back and forth with quickness. From afar with cocktails you witness. Squeeze your girl's arm, summer her to look at this. She agrees with what your eyes see. But something's deeper than just the features. Lead the decks and move through to Nietzsche. Nonchalant right from the beginning. Slightly grinning, feels like I'm winning. Southern girl who's fat, out and pretty. Meets legend from the big city. You're smart though, you can match with me. Come on SK, let's get busy.
So you began, you started your own label.
Yes.
You plan on signing any MCs, any rappers?
That's definitely not on the agenda right now.
Understood.
But I'd totally be open to it. I think the thing about what I want to achieve for the label is it to really be a home for artists who are already developed, who already have a really great sense of their artistry, of their imaging, who don't really feel or want that marketing push, who really have it together and are the package already. If there was an MC who already had that, was really firm in it, then heck yeah, I'd be open to it.
Are you structuring your label as the way you would ideally have liked your label
Absolutely.
Relationships to exist?
Absolutely. And I think that that's probably why having an MC is not on the immediate agenda, because I'm so, so sensitive to having expertise behind whatever projects I work on. And although I'm a fan of hip-hop and I love it, I by no means I'm an expert on it. And so in that situation, I'd want to bring in an A&R that really knows their stuff. Saint Records really, really started from me being on a major label
yeah.
for two albums, me putting out this last album completely independently, and I actually put it out through my friend's label. It was a small indie.
Is that the Terrible Records?
Yes.
I'm like, tell me about what's so great about Terrible Records.
I know. He asked for it with that name. but he actually was a dear friend of mine, played him the record. It really was just something that was super organic and just fell into place. Like, I love this record. I'd love to put it out.
Right.
And
that's another musician-run label, right? I mean, Chris Taylor.
Yes.
Of Grizzly Bear.
Mm-hmm. It's him and Ethan who run the mm-hmm. label. And I knew in that situation that I really would have full creative and artistic control and behind every decision, from the font on the artwork
right.
to where I wanted to premiere the song would be based solely off of my decisions. And so I think kind of going through that whole phase and transition, I really saw the strengths in the major labels.
Mm.
I saw the strengths in the indie labels, and I saw some things that I wasn't a fan of both. And really just, like I said, housing artists that already feel like they have that sense of development and know clearly and can define what their marketplace should and mm. what they want it to be and what they want it to feel like, which I think that even if you have that and you go into a major label situation, there's so many cooks in the kitchen that that line of clarity can even become unclear to you.
Did you come across those sort of challenges with your
first
two records?
Oh, for sure.
Did it affect the entire, like, songwriting process? Not necessarily recording, but just the songwriting.
I was really lucky with Soul Angel that album was finished and packaged before I signed to Interscope. There was maybe one conversation that we had with the first single of should this be re-recorded? Should this be recomped, et cetera, because Pharrell actually produced that. And he's one of the few people that I've ever let, because he is freaking Pharrell, produce my vocals, which I'm very, very particular about. He has a completely different approach for producing vocals, especially for that song. He wanted it to be a one take. He wanted it to reign really true to the era of the music that was such an influence on that record. And, you know, there might have been one conversation on the music side of that. Like, it's a little too raw. There's a couple bad notes. And I actually, you know, was open to re-exploring that. And we tried and we tried, and it just, the magic was gone. So that was maybe the only thing that musically I kind of experienced the change in, because the album was done. But on the creative side of things, in every other vein, the artwork, the videos, the touring, you know, I had a lot of challenges in that experience, for sure. And then my first album, you know, I was such a youngin. I was 14 when I started writing that album, 15 when it came out. I knew even then that I had like a very distinctive idea musically of what I wanted the record to sound like. And I wrote probably about 80% of that record. Towards the middle to the end, there definitely were conversations like, why are we letting this little girl write her music? We need to bring in the powerhouses, etc., which ended up happening. You know, Pharrell, Timbaland, Rockwilder, they all worked on that record, and then they would come in and I'd be this little bratty teenager like, no, I write my own stuff. And they would actually give me a chance, and, you know, I still feel proud of a lot of those records on that album.
Well, you should. I mean, it's odd expression of a time where, at that age, that's what you experience.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the things that comes across with your art, is that it is honest.
Well, thank you.
You know, to just who you are. What I get from you is that you're very eclectic, and your just love of music and living life. And it comes across honest. And I know that that's a challenge for artists in major label situations where you just fully no barriers, just want to completely like express the song, the art, the vision, and it might not be wholly supported.
Right.
So your new record, it's on Saint Records.
Yes.
What does that feel like?
It feels great. And now I'm in the stage where the last record that I did, the EP, I kind of, you live and you learn. I won't call it a mistake, but I learned the lesson of a lot of times we would have these sessions where we'd all just grab a synth or a drum pad or whatever and just jam. And then I'd write the melody and the lyrics and just it kind of be very second nature. And then I'd have like 20 sessions with 11 instruments and had to edit it all and make it into the album that it was, which took me a year and a half.
Wow.
Because we were just going ham, and you're so in the moment and you're acting off of the momentum and the vibe. So that's really what took me so long, is I was editing these songs, and then you feel disconnected because they happened so long ago. And so it was definitely a very disciplined process. And so this time I'm like, we're gonna jam for 3 songs, edit those, jam for, you know what I mean? Which, in a sense, I still feel really good about that process. Some of my favorite artists, like when I learned of Sade's process and how every musician is just in the room and it's really just a capturing of the vibe.
Yeah.
But it's hard when you're the one who goes and edits it, which I've tried to trust people with that process.
Yeah, that's what producers go through. So you like being a producer?
I do and I don't. I actually did my first track completely alone, like in a room by myself. And I actually really enjoyed that. I always, you know, had someone start something and then I finished it, or I added a synth here, or I added a bass line here, or whatever, but I had never fully made a track, like just a beat from top to bottom without anyone in the space. And that was really, really a good feeling. So,
is this the song that you tweeted about? Wrote and produced a song yesterday inspired by Kush, Big Pun, Kirk Franklin, Sean, and Savage. And Pharrell.
What did you call it? Mega something.
Then one fly lady sang it into mega jamness.
Mega jamness.
It wasn't me. I wasn't the fly lady. But someone else did. And I'm really, really excited to get that out there. But yeah, that was my mood board. I actually really, really loved Kirk Franklin and the New Family's album.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about gospel.
Yeah. I mean, just melodically, those songs were so, so good.
They were so hot in the 90s.
They
were. And people forget about that. They were, like, on MTV all the time.
Yeah, especially the one with, like, Bono and Mary.
Oh, yeah.
Here's my shoulder, you can lean on me. Mm-hmm. That was good. It was really good. I've been listening to a lot of that, a lot of Kim Burrell.
I love Kim Burrell.
Yeah. Holy Ghost is like how I actually learned how to do runs. I just played it for like maybe 2 or 3 weeks until I could actually connect those dots. I still can't, but you know, I try.
Creating me a new heart, oh God. Take not the Holy Spirit from me.
So I want to ask you about some stuff that went down after you put out True.
Yes.
When you were criticizing journalists for not knowing their history and their culture. You said something that says, you know, you need to know the culture of R&B before you're going to write about R&B. Can you define the culture of R&B?
For sure. I mean, it's all relative to each individualized experience. But I know that there's no way to really explain the emotional and physical and mental reaction when you're at a party in seventh grade and like a 702 record comes on. And you know what I mean? Like, it's all of those things. It's like the gelling down your baby hair because Chili did it and you want it to look like Chili so much. It's like the whole phenomenon of like Tommy Hilfiger after Aaliyah Ward, all of those elements. And then you have like your very, very obscure ones too. And I would just have these conversations where I would use different references, or I would talk about Jaheim, or I would just anything, anyone, and just kind of get nothing back. And I think if you're going to be a writer about something, or someone, our culture, really, really taking the time to study the same way that I said I would feel some type of way about putting out hip hop, because right. I'm not incredibly knowledgeable about it. And there's a lot of situations where I feel irony involved when, you know, R&B and hip hop is expressed in the indie world. There's a lot of times when I feel like the juxtaposition becomes a thing. There's a lot of times when I've seen the backgrounds of a lot of these writers on their Twitter profiles, and it's like, you know, see murder, throwing up a gang sign. There's just a lot of ironic references that I constantly was being surrounded by. It's not something that I just feel. It's something that has been written about. It's something that has been expressed by a lot of people. And I had no problem vocalizing about it. And I thought that it was really interesting that even that became a joke in itself. You know, I had mentioned about knowing Brandy album cuts.
Oh, right.
And that became a joke. And it was like precisely what I was speaking about. You know, this is real to a lot of people. Yeah. Brandy is a goddess in R&B to a lot of people. She is really the foundation for a lot of this very innovative, progressive, experimental R&B. Brandy influenced a lot of that. Frank Ocean will say it, Miguel will say it, and that became a joke in itself. The next day, it was like, here are our top 10 deep Brandy album cuts list. You know, that in itself just sort of reflected the tone that I was speaking about. And, you know, it was also just like a generic idea of just the type of artist being covered by a lot of music critics, because I wasn't seeing Brandy covered on those sites. I wasn't seeing Tweet covered on a lot of those sites. And so that was really my stance on it, was just sort of vocalizing that. And, you know, I took a lot of shit for it, and it was fine. I actually got told not to bite the hand that fed me by one of
them. I'm like, by who? Nah, no, don't.
I'll tell you later.
I want to know.
Can we have one moment to remember the I Want to Be Down remix?
Yo, so good.
That video, that was like the answer to the Flavor in Your Ear remix, that yeah. video.
I will girl that you could be down for, 'cause when I look at you I feel something tell me that you're the kind of guy that I should make a move on.
I get exotic with the melodic tune, I get hypnotic with the moon, but you got to put me down soon. I flip a sideshow if you come my way, up, down, and around, even sideways. I'm about as ready as the light can get. We can go all out, I ain't afraid of the sweat, but yet I bet you got the techniques to freak a girl inside out. What's that all about? Can I have some of that?
And it was also like, you know, you grew up, you had like, I'm Brandy, I'm Monica, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like what that meant to girls, what it meant to identify with this one. I love them both. I couldn't choose, you know what I mean? But it's like those things are so relative in the context of writing about R&B. And, you know, 90s R&B, let's face it, has become very trendy over the last few years.
Yeah.
But it's very surface level.
Well, why do you think that people in general, maybe even like pop culture, white culture, maligns R&B? I mean, there's the theory that people hated on disco so much, that disco sucks thing went so far that people extrapolate it to R&B. Is it race? Is it like too sexual, too emotional?
I can't answer that. I mean, I just saw another article that kind of started off saying that R&B music was meant to be a cliche. It was a review of an album. And it's like, I really don't understand, because my love affair is so deep with R&B music. I could never, ever put it in the context of being a cliche in any way. I can't really find it. It went on to say that, like, the fact that these lyrics are able to be expressed and it started naming some lyrics that I didn't find very hard to express musically at all. But I really can't say. I get confused by that myself. But I think, you know, it also has been something that has become such a part of the fabric of my life. My parents only played Isley Brothers, Marvin Gaye. That's when New Kids came out and, like, we wanted to jam that. My mom was like, put that thing on, get my damn record on. And you know what I mean? So, like, from old school to 90s to recent, like, it's just always been there. So I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think every genre gets that sort of abuse or that
absolutely
that sort of attack. I mean,
I agree.
When you asked that question, I was just thinking of groups like Atlantic Star and stuff like that. Like, at some point, the music just seemed like it lacked passion. And then you go back and you listen to those songs now and you say, oh, I can see where it meant something, but was it just, we're going in the studio and we got a job to finish and complete this record. Like, you know, everyone goes through that
Of
thing. So you don't know where the passion is lost. And it just seems like there was a period in, for R&B music that it just, when you listen to the Gap Band or even going farther back to like the Isley Brothers or Marvin Gaye, there's a lot of passion in it. You know, if you go back to like even a Chubby Checker or something like that, like there's just something that was missing. And hip hop is suffering the same sort of thing where it was a period where it just was like, what is going on? What are we talking about? Like, how does this advance us? And is this real feeling or is this just chasing paper? Is this chasing something that has, it's meaningful to the artist, whatever it is that your ambitions are, but to the fullness of the culture of what hip hop is, it's just so disconnected. Jazz went through it.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I think you're right, and I'm happy that you took that stand to speak up about it, because there are so many R&B artists who are such a vibrant and alive art form, and it's just, you know, you would think it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Depending on what forums you're looking at.
Which is ridiculous, because, like, Jaheim sold, what, more than 4 million albums?
Yeah.
Ghetto Love, right? Was that the first one? That went platinum.
I was tempted, slide across the floor to dry my digits. Then you looked and turned away like you weren't with it. But I knew in my heart that I could rip it. Girl, I'm gifted, what you want to do?
All I really want is your ghetto love.
Ghetto love.
24/7, we'll be making love.
Oh.
I'll take it down, if you want me to.
Yeah, yeah, baby.
Just one of the things I want to do to you.
To the old
Don't you be scared. Take my time.
Take my time.
Whatever it takes, I've got
to make your mind.
I mean, there's just so, so many overlooked R&B artists. And I think it's really just about, again, being sensitive to whatever you're addressing culturally. I just always try to have a sensitivity to it and what that might make someone feel. So when you click on someone's Twitter page and it's like, why? Why is C-Murder like your background? Why is that the
it's
face
jokes,
of your
man.
Thoughts
all jokes.
And your voice, you know?
I mean, it is about, like, this whole artifice versus authenticity debate is also about, like, having real feelings and being clever.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Can you just explain comping? Because you use that word a lot, but I don't think that everybody knows what that means.
Comping is essentially, you can comp anything, but vocal comping is when you sing through a part a few times. Typically, I sing through something like 5 times, and I pick the best line of each verse or phrase.
It's like punching in.
Punching in is when you actually have selected the line before, and then you just punch in that particular word. Comping is when you sing a verse like 5 times and you decide the first half I'm going to keep from the first time I did it, the second half I'm going to keep from the third time I did it, etc. But I also comp musicians too. Like, I'll have a bass player come in and play through the whole song, and then I'll comp the best parts, which a lot of times I use live musicians, but I don't want it to have that live funky sound. So I'll just take the best loop of a drum part and repeat it over and over and over again so that there's consistency and it feels a little bit more programmed. But I have a love-hate relationship with comping as well. A lot of times
in the digital age, absolutely.
It's just been hard forever, though. No.
Well, when it was strictly 2-inch. Oh, it's different for rappers.
Right.
I will say that, and I learned this in the Lucy Pearl process.
Okay.
I really got my education fully in Lucy Pearl.
Did you?
For rappers, it's like, you know, like 2 takes maximum,
right.
And that's it. Raphael is somewhat different because he's kind of a vibe person.
He I've worked with him.
He'll go with it, but Dawn was way different, and she would do like lots of takes, and Raphael would go, I don't see how you could sit there. I'm like, I'm just fascinated. Like, how are we gonna go through all of that? And she would go through like, you know, like 10 takes maybe.
Yeah. Be a very tedious process. I've learned to sort of let go. You know, I actually produced other people's vocals for a long time when I first signed my publishing deal, and I had just sort of decided that I only wanted to be a writer. I would be in all of these writing sessions and I would comp other people, and actually I've written stuff for Kelly and my sister, and like,
when you say you let go, what do you mean by that?
I mean, like, I've let go of being a super perfectionist on every single note and wanting the pitch to be absolutely perfect all of the time. And I grew up watching, like, the best of the best. You know, I watch Rodney Jerkins comp vocals, so it's, I've seen that really, really particular tedious process, and now I've like sort of learned, same thing with Raphael, like where it's more about the vibe, it's more about the take, and I've also learned to only write songs and melodies that really work for my voice and that I won't have issues doing live, because you can get really, really comfortable in the comping process. Out of 5 takes, maybe one of those high notes
that you struggled
to do, nailed it. And then live, you're having that challenge of really having to recreate that. And so after Hadley Street, which I had a lot of that, you know, I would comp all of these notes that were not as easy for me to naturally do. And then live, I would have to belt them out. And so the comping process has become a lot more relaxed. You know, I'll only do maybe 4 or 5 takes, and it just makes life so much easier.
Yeah, you can control the situation with 5 takes.
Yeah.
So I saw you play, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. I've watched you sort of go from more careful to less careful.
Yeah.
I think about when you let go.
Yeah.
I remember one time, I think your mom was there too, at Bowery. You were careful most of the time, and then one time you just went for it. And your boyfriend stood up, and your mom stood up, and I think your sister was there. They all stood up, and they're like, she did it!
Aww.
And I was like, they must talk to her about letting go.
Yeah, well, I think actually, I know the Bowery shows, one of two, they were my first 2 shows, and I had done a rehearsal show for just friends and family, maybe 4 days before the Bowery show. To be quite honest, it was so bad.
Oh, no.
And they all came backstage afterwards and did the obligatory family, like, oh, that was great. And I was like, it was awful, and you know it.
Oh, my God.
So we just grinded for 72 hours nonstop. We brought in a musical director.
Oh, wow.
It was such a major improvement. And we were all pretty scared because we were pretty bad. And I had like a semi-structure of how I wanted the show to roll out, but I really, really sort of have always identified with really solid, entertaining live shows, no matter what the genre is. You know, I just really appreciate great and solid type musicianship and really having a show format where it rolls through and all of the different nuances and movements really take you through a journey. And that was something that we were having a hard time achieving. And so we've actually redone the show because, you know, the independent struggle is, it's real. And so it's like it costs to rehearse. Yeah. You have to get the rehearsal space. You have to pay the band for rehearsal because they're taking time out of their day. Yeah. And if you really want to have a solid rehearsal, you have to pay for a sound man so you can practice vocal cues and all of that. And I really didn't have the resources in the beginning to do that. So over time, playing these shows, after every show, we would have powwow. I would have notes. And we'd go over and we'd really kind of restructure and redo. And now I feel really, really good about the show. But it's taken time, you know.
So you talk about movement. You used to have some dance moves with Dev.
Yes.
And then in the videos you got the moves. How important is dance to R&B?
I mean, just historically, it's gone hand in hand. I grew up watching a lot of videos from the 60s R&B soul movement. My mother played the Supremes, the Veltones, the Marvelettes. My father would play the Jackson 5. And then obviously like in the 80s, New Edition, in the hip-hop era in the 80s, folks were dancing. And then in the 90s, they did dance.
You don't dance.
But it was more of a
little
like,
secret. I danced with the Jungle Brothers, you know, like
what?
Anyone ever has video of that, I'm like,
oh my God.
My ripped up jeans going.
But 80s dance was like definitely the choreography was a lot more repetitive.
Yeah.
And there were like maybe 5 or 6 moves and then, you know, the variables would be different during the 8 count, but it wasn't like the 90s is really when it became about N1, N2, N3, N4, N5, N6, N7, N8. The 80s, you would just do the same move for a whole 8 count before you switched into the other thing, which is kind of what I wanted to reflect in our choreography. And I actually choreographed our show, which isn't rocket science. It's very simple movement. And a lot of the references are very obviously based off of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis when they'd perform with Janet. There was a Sheila E. performance that really, really, really kind of blew my mind. Mm. I think it was the American Music Awards. And everyone, every single person, the keyboard players, the synth players, the guitar players, the bass players, did the choreography. Her keyboard player was actually a lady in like 6-inch stilettos. And I remember like yelling to my band, if she can do it, you can do it. She has on 6-inch heels. In the beginning, everyone in the band was not receptive to, to this idea of adding these moves. And then over time, everybody got more comfortable. Dev was always game. He kind of knew, like, from the beginning, I had expressed that that's what I wanted to do. Once it came down to actually do it, I was like, you know, I wasn't playing right. And he was like, no, I know, I know. So I actually have video of me like coming up with the routines and teaching him, and he was totally down for it. And then in my videos, really it's just freestyle.
Tell me the truth, boy, I'm not losing you for good.
I actually was a ballet dancer. I studied ballet from 3 until 13. But like very seriously, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a contemporary ballet dancer. I wanted to go to Juilliard. I remember my father took me there when I was 12, and I was just like, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. And then at 13, my sisters, Destiny's Child, were going on tour. They were opening up for Christina Aguilera. And they had just changed group members. And their whole show was structured around, very meticulously, this choreography.
Did you know the dancers?
No, not at all. But they had just changed members, and Michelle had rehearsed and learned this very particular show, and then one of the dancers actually just up and said that she was pregnant, and she quit like maybe a week and a half before the tour left. So my sister was like, oh, you dance, just fill in. Like, by the time we audition someone and teach them all, it's gonna be too late. And like, Michelle really needed to rely on this structure. And so I was like, cool, I'm down. But I had no idea how to do hip-hop dancing. I was so awkward, and it was just a lot of pelvic thrusting, and I didn't know what I was doing. And actually, their choreographer, who's still her choreographer, is really hardcore. He's notoriously known as a, like, junior Debbie Allen, you know, like, you need to, like, yelling, and he would always be like, this isn't goddamn ballet, you better, you know. So it was very, very stressful, but I had, like, a week to learn the whole show. Note you that most of the dancers had, like, a month. They had been in rehearsal, and I actually did it for about 2 years, so I just had a lot of energy. I was not very great at it, and I had very long braids. They were bright red, so that really helped me. I learned the importance of hair and dance, marriage. So it's like definitely ingrained in me, the spirit of movement. But it really was just like wanting the show again to have those nuances and to really reflect the music and the era that we were so inspired by for the record. It's very interesting, you know, when we do the movements, and sometimes I can be like singing my little heart out and people are just like, cool. And then I do like a little two-step and it's like, woo!
Yeah, exactly. It just feels, I don't know, more complete. Like you're really getting something special. It's like, oh, wow, ooh. Versus, oh, yeah, okay. Just broke all the glass in here. All right, cool. Wish you a lot of success.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was nice. This was mellow. I had my carrot juice.
Thank you for coming. I think you, it's not even a thing, you definitely have pioneered something brand new.
Thank you.
What we're doing with microphone checking, something that actually Franny's been passionate about, is
amazing.
Representing R&B. Sweet. Up here at NPR. So
yeah, and I love just hearing your references. It's been great.
I remember in seventh grade, at that time I was in Catholic schools, and we had the dances, and it was all R&B.
Oh, yeah. You but that freaked was like, off at the dances.
Oh, yeah. Was that what it was called? Freaking?
It was definitely freaking, yeah.
That was a mess.
Yeah. Like when you feel the guys, little
feel
poke.
A little poke coming through on you.
Yeah, all of that.
Yeah. Thanks again.
No, thank you. But I know you